So welcome back to the Neurology Exam Prep Podcast. My name is Aaron Bauer. I'm one of the PGY3 neurology residents here at Yale. And today we're going to be talking about myoclonus with both Dr. Schaefer and Dr. Moeller.
Thanks for having me on. I'm excited.
Thanks, Aaron. I think that'll be a lot of fun. Our listeners may know that Dr. Schaefer is a movement disorder specialist, and I'm an epilepsy specialist, and myoclonus exists in the borderland between those two specialties. So I think this will be really fun to team up and tackle this very complicated process.
Agreed. This is definitely one of the weaker points in my education. So going through this a little bit systemically and systematically was helpful and definitely learned a lot from this one. So very happy to share what I've kind of gone through with everyone. The general setup moving forward for today, we're going to talk a little bit about the phenomenology of myoclonus. You know, what is it? What do we see on exam? What other things are associated with it or can look like it? And then we'll focus more on the localization and through the localization, a little bit about etiologic considerations and ultimately a brief discussion of just the basic treatments that one can consider for myoclonus. And if it's okay, then we can kind of start with what exactly is myoclonus? What do we see on exam? In general, myoclonus is going to be one of your hyperkinetic movement disorders. Generally, it's characterized by very brief, involuntary muscular jerks is kind of how it's described when seen. This can be both in the positive direction and negative direction, so positive and negative myoclonus. Positive myoclonus is going to be more of a jerky contraction of the muscle, and negative myoclonus will be a jerky kind of relaxation of the muscle that then comes back.
Can I jump in here?
Yes.
I just want to say, you know, the other word for negative myoclonus would be asterixis. And the reason that we test asterixis classically with the stop position, stopping traffic position, is because it requires consistent activation of the wrist extensors. And so you're able to see that involuntary relaxation of the muscle and then a recovery to back to the position.
Definitely, very much so. And then in terms of the additional movement disorders, or at least hyperkinetic movement disorders that may be confused with myoclonus or one should think of when approaching a patient, we can generally think of a few. So one could be just a tic, so very simple motor tics may be confused with myoclonus. Generally, they're going to be more repetitive. They'll be stereotyped. And in terms of tics, there's usually an associated urge, and they'll be briefly suppressible. In terms of something like a startle, sometimes we may see patients with a pathologically exaggerated startle, and that's called hyperplexia. However, generally speaking, this is going to be involving more proximal distal muscles. It'll be bilateral. It'll be synchronous, but it will be very stereotyped, moving with like arm abduction and then flexion of the neck, trunk, and extremities. It's a very stereotyped movement for a startle as well. For chorea, this is going to be non-stereotyped. And instead of this jerky kind of muscular jerking that we see with myoclonus, for chorea, one would think of more flowing hyperkinetic movement disorders.
Chorea is just a little slower than myoclonus. The actual contraction of the muscle is slower in chorea. They can be difficult to distinguish.
And the only last one that sometimes we see, particularly in children, in very young children and infants, is the shivering can be a little bit different and difficult to really distinguish between the myoclonic jerking. And that's usually the big difference is it's a much more clustered appearance in terms of shivering and a little bit more generalized.
Sarah, can you talk us through, I think all of us have seen, you know, multifocal myoclonus and toxic encephalopathy or epileptic myoclonus and somebody with juvenile myoclonic epilepsy, common sorts of versions of this. But, you know, there's broad phenomenology, as Aaron is alluding to, And that's the part actually I have trouble with too, you know, focal, segmental, generalized, and then where it occurs, you know, or in what context it occurs, with rest or with activation or in between. Can you talk through your evaluation of somebody with myoclonus and some tricks that our listeners might have to distinguish the different types?
Sure. Well, just to talk a little bit about the language. So focal myoclonus is, you know, in one for example, in one nerve distribution, such as hemifacial spasm is just in the distribution of the facial nerve. Segmental, when we refer to movement disorders, means in segments that are adjacent to each other in the body. So segmental dystonia could be in the neck and arm, for example, because those are segmentally related to each other. Generalized, in when we talk about myoclonus, means the whole body all at once. It can kind of look like a startle, and it's one myoclonic jerk in the body, whereas multifocal is all over the body, but lots of little myoclonic jerks.
Now that's very clear. And what about what provokes them, whether they occur in with rest or action or with certain tasks?
Sure. So there are certain myoclonic syndromes that may be more specific to one thing or another. For example, post-anoxic myoclonic syndrome called Lance-Adams syndrome is classically an action-induced myoclonus. So when the patient is at rest, they don't have much by way of myoclonus. And as soon as they lift up their arm to do something, the myoclonus comes out in full force. There are also stimulus-induced myoclonus that we see, and we do test for this on examination. And this can be a little bit difficult to distinguish from a startle. And, you know, when we're trying to evaluate a startle, we might clap very loudly, unexpectedly in the exam room and see if they have a hyperecplectic response. But with stimulus-induced myoclonus, we may take a pin or the reflex hammer and tap on their arm, and then they may have a local myoclonic response to the tap. And that is often seen in patients with neurodegenerative cortical diseases, such as corticobasal syndrome or Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease.
Well, that's a $60 word if I've ever heard it, which is hyperecplexia, which is this exaggerated startle. And
yeah, you heard me say that very slowly because it's difficult to say.
You stuck the landing on it. That was very good, but a good one for our listeners to know about.
Very good. So I think we definitely touched on a lot of the key things for the phenomenology of myoclonus there, the basic definition of it being a very jerky involuntary hyperkinetic movement disorder, the differences between positive and negative myoclonus, the other features that we really want to try and note on the exam, including, you know, it's being focal, segmental, or generalized, and what kind of specific activities or at rest these movements will occur. And then some of the additional movement disorders, at least to think about, including like startle, tics, chorea, shivering. So I think that's a really good start to kind of lay the groundwork for this talk. So I think at this point, we can talk a little bit more about localization, which Dr. Schaefer has alluded to a little bit. So we can think about this like most of the problems in NeurAxis. We can kind of go through each one step by step. In terms of, you know, the highest level that we can get to in terms of cortical, we can think of essentially this will generally be multifocal or a generalized process. Typically, classically, at least, affecting the face, the distal limbs, it will be both spontaneous, action-induced, or stimulus-sensitive, as we've talked about a little bit here in terms of like touch or visual stimuli. This can be both negative and positive when we see on exam in terms of the myoclonic activity. In terms of some broad things to think about in terms of looking at myoclonus with some additional information in order to figure out exactly the localization. Some people can utilize polymyography to help narrow down where exactly the myoclonic activity is originating from. And we can talk about this through each one. So for example, with cortical myoclonic activity on the polymyography, so when we're just recording over the affected muscles, the activity generally will be less than 100 milliseconds. And this will be correlated with EEG activity as well.
Yeah, just to comment here, this is the type of myoclonus with which I have the most experience as an epileptologist, because a very common type of cortical myoclonus would be epileptic myoclonus, most commonly with disorders like juvenile myoclonic epilepsy, also with the progressive myoclonus epilepsy disorders, and then, of course, in children with a number of epileptic myoclonic disorders. And in all cases, there's brief synchronous bursts, which can be seen as spikes or polyspikes on EEG, on plain EEG. And as you said, Aaron, the actual myoclonic movements are extremely brief and extremely quick. You know, you're saying less than 100 milliseconds. And my rule of thumb with epileptic myoclonus, with a subtype of cortical myoclonus, is that the movement is so quick that it really cannot be voluntarily simulated. So that if I wanted to simulate or show what a jerking looked like, it would be slower than the movement that you would see with epileptic myoclonus in general. That may not always be the case, but is often the case. And 100 milliseconds, you know, that's a tenth of a second. So these are very quick, brief, jerky movements. So the things to remember are brief, jerky movements, very quick, harder to simulate, and associated with spikes or polyspikes on scalp EEG in most cases.
No, thank you for that extra information. That's definitely something once we get to etiology that I'm looking forward to hearing a lot more detail from you as well. For moving down the neuraxis a little bit, we can start thinking about subcortical etiologies and subcortical localization for myoclonus. So once we kind of get into the brainstem, this is similarly to cortical will be more generalized or synchronous activity, usually a little bit more axial and proximal involvement, and similarly can be either spontaneous or stimulus sensitive. And then once we get below the cortical level, this is really where the polymyography is going to be longer duration, so less short, generally greater than 100 milliseconds. Dr. Schaefer, would you want to talk about the myoclonic dystonia? That was a new topic for me.
Oh, sure. Myoclonus dystonia, that gets more into etiology. That's a genetic syndrome that is also called DYT11, and it's seen in children. And it's called myoclonus dystonia clinically because some people may have more myoclonus, some people may have more dystonia, some may have a lot of both, but it's a generally not extraordinarily progressive issue that is familial and is, as I said, characterized by both myoclonus and dystonia.
So heading out of the subcortical regions, then we can start thinking about spinal. So once we hit into the spine, this can be broken down generally into two different kind of subcategories as well. So we have segmental and propriospinal. So with the segmental spinal myoclonus, this is generally going to just involve a single segment. So as Dr. Schaefer alluded to before, kind of just like single proximal limb or maybe up into the face, more segments of the spine itself. These are generally going to be spontaneous, less likely action induced. And similarly to the subcortical myoclonus, this will be longer duration of polymyography activity, so greater than 100 milliseconds. In terms of propriospinal, this is generally going to be a very fixed pattern, and it is all about the axial muscles of the trunk and the abdomen. And it's kind of an up and down pattern for what you see with the myoclonic activity. And this one will be more both spontaneous and stimulus sensitive. And similarly on polymyography, we'll have that longer duration of greater than 100 milliseconds.
I should say that one way that we do examine these patients who come in with histories consistent with propriospinal myoclonus is that we lie them down and we tap on their stomachs and try to induce the myoclonic jerk, which, as you said, spreads from the area of injury proximally and distally, affecting basically the whole body more or less simultaneously.
Thank you for that additional info. In terms of the next kind of segments moving down the neuraxis, so after the spinal cord, we can start thinking about the peripheral nervous system. And peripheral myoclonus is generally going to be much more focal, generally just affecting maybe a part of the distal limb. It will be spontaneous, it'll be action-induced, and generally is going to be accompanied by a degree of weakness and or atrophy, just as we're affecting the peripheral nerves at that time. In terms of electrophysiology, this one would be slightly different than either the cortical, subcortical, or spinal. Generally, there will be relatively short bursts of activity as well, and usually less than even 50 milliseconds, and is associated with other signs of lower motor neuron damage, be it fasciculations or underlying myokymia.
I think peripheral myoclonus is really interesting because, and this may be an oversimplification, but I kind of think of it almost like an epilepsy of the peripheral nerves, right? The pathophysiology of peripheral myoclonus, the most common of those disorders being hemifacial spasm, for example, is ephaptic transmission between axons because of focal demyelination. So the most common cause of hemispatial spasm, or one of the most common causes, would be neurovascular compression, right? So compression of an aberrant blood vessel adjacent to the brainstem near the CP angle, causing focal demyelination of an irritation of the facial nerve, the proximal facial nerve. And so that when one nerve fiber fires, the adjacent nerve fibers fire simultaneously and synchronously, so that you, rather than having sort of more nuanced motor control of the face, you have this sudden activation of a large population of axons going to multiple different regions of the face, and you get simultaneous synchronous contraction of the facial muscles. And this can be further worsened by activation of those muscles, right? If you ask the patient to close their eyes for a prolonged period of time, really squint and activate the facial nerve, you'll often see a burst of these facial jerking that's happening afterward. And it really is all about crosstalk and synchronous discharges within the axons, which sort of feels to me like an epileptic paradigm, but of course, this is the way I see the world. And interestingly enough, to carry it forward, right, before botulinum toxin therapy, the treatment for these disorders tended to be anti-seizure medications, you know, carbamazepine or something like that. Now, where my argument falls down is that they don't work all that well, and that in the most cases, treatment is going to be more effective with decompression or botulinum toxin, and neurovascular decompression or botulinum toxin. But kind of think of it as an epilepsy of the peripheral nerve. I'm digressing a little bit, but I kind of think of trigeminal neuralgia as being the same thing, you know, spontaneous aphaptic transmission through the trigeminal nerve causing spontaneous synchronous activation of a large number of axons leading to excruciating pain because it's a sensory phenomenon. So there's your little pathophysiology corner. And another $60 word, aphaptic, which is about axonal crosstalk.
Well, thank you, Dr. Muller. It's definitely good to go back to the most fundamentals that we can, especially during these talks. So I definitely appreciate that. Kind of to summarize, so now we've gone through at least the general localization that we can think through. So be it cortical, subcortical, spinal, and moving out into the periphery. And we've discussed kind of the basic overview of what they kind of look at and some of the key electrophysiologic findings on polymyography that we will see. So I think at this point, it would be a good time to start discussing at least some of the etiologic considerations. So once you have clinically seen myoclonus, have at least an idea of where it's localizing to, then you can kind of start thinking about how you want to approach it diagnostically speaking. So cortical and subcortical myoclonus generally have a much larger differential and will be one that we'll talk about second. To start, I think we can do a little bit of a warm-up with at least peripheral or spinal etiologies to start. So in terms of spinal etiologies, generally speaking, myoclonic activity and spinal myoclonus is usually seen after pretty bad traumatic or compressive injuries, is generally going to be, you know, where people will see it most clinically, just given the, you know, relative occurrence of these injuries in the population. Outside of that, especially if somebody's coming in with an infectious prodrome, fevers, chills, systemic signs, you can also start thinking about infectious etiology, so infectious myelitic processes, and in somebody maybe with a autoimmune history, concern for MS, NMO, you know, more the autoimmune pathway, then you can start thinking about more systemic rheumatologic processes as well.
Sarah, I would love to hear you talk about this. This is, again, an area I have huge challenges with. So you talked about spinal segmental myoclonus and proprio-spinal myoclonus as being sort of two distinct entities. So what do these patients look like and how do we work them up?
Well, it's really more focal or segmental than you know where to image in that person's spine, right? To try to figure out if there is, as Aaron said, any kind of inflammation or compressive lesion and cord signal that might show you a focus for the myoclonus. People with proprio-spinal myoclonus, we will image their spine and hope that we see something that explains what's going on with them. But I have to say that often the spinal imaging is not remarkable. And so there's a debate in the field actually as to whether the proprio-spinal myoclonus syndrome is related to some kind of spinal injury or hyperexcitability that is at a level that is just unable to be seen on MRI, or if this is actually a lot of times functional in patients. And so there are whole groups of people who think that propriospinal myoclonus only exists as a functional disorder. So this is a debate within movement disorders, and it's tough even electrophysiologically to tell, because as Aaron mentioned, if you're looking at cortical myoclonus, the bursts are less than 100 milliseconds, which is shorter, as Dr. Moeller said, than people are able to mimic in a functional disorder. But in propriospinal myoclonus, the bursts are much longer than that. And so it's difficult to distinguish electrophysiologically between a functional and organic etiology.
I'm feeling better about being confused about this disorder, especially propriospinal myoclonus. It's somehow reassuring to hear that experts like you are somewhat challenged and bewildered by this in many cases as well.
Absolutely. Experts are always challenged and bewildered.
That's how you become experts.
The more expert you get, the more challenged and bewildered you become.
I should get that on a t-shirt. Okay, so outside of the spinal etiologies, looking at the periphery, I think we've kind of discussed a decent amount of etiology as well. Thinking about, you know, like underlying causes for plexopathies, radiculopathies, and I know Dr. Moeller's talked a little bit more in the case of hemifacial spasm and focal irritability that can really lead to this hyperexcitability of the peripheral nerve. So any of those etiologies, be it infectious, rheumatologic, traumatic, can all lead to some of these peripheral myoclonic processes. Particularly once we're getting into more peripheral nerves, then at something that may be beneficial diagnostically, one could think about as an EMG nerve conduction study to really isolate down to the nerves or nerve roots or plexus that is involved. So moving forward, we can really start talking about kind of the meat of a lot of myoclonus and cortical myoclonus, which does have a pretty broad differential, to say the least. And we'll have Dr. Moeller comment a little bit specifically on myoclonic epilepsies and progressive myoclonic epilepsies. Generally speaking, coming and assessing somebody with myoclonus and you're kind of localizing them to a cortical or subcortical region, one of the first things that's relatively good to think about first are some kind of toxic metabolic considerations. One thing that we see a lot of, at least in the hospital when we get consulted on this, is drug-induced or overall systemic illness that is really contributing to the cortical hyperexcitability and consequent more generalized myoclonic activity that we can see in our patients. Some of these toxic metabolic considerations, one of the first things that we can do when going through a patient, particularly a good medication reconciliation, to see if there are any contributory medications at this time. Some of the ones that are at least neuropsych related that we generally prescribe frequently as neurologists and should be aware of would be some anti-seizure medications like phenytoin, gabapentin, pregabalin, lamotrigine. Some anti-Parkinson's drugs can also contribute to myoclonus. Sinemet, bromocriptine, amantadine, entacapone can all contribute. Some antipsychotics, more of the older generations like haloperidol, can definitely contribute to a degree of myoclonus. Clozapine, olanzapine as well. And then in terms of more antidepressants, definitely lithium, the SSRIs, MAOIs, and TCAs can all lead to myoclonic activity, especially in super therapeutic ranges.
I think so, what you're telling us, Aaron, is that if you see transient myoclonus, it's a good bet that it could be drug related.
Very much so.
So the things that, just to narrow this down a little bit, the things that I look at first and foremost would be the sodium channel blockers like phenytoin and carbamazepine. And as we said, carbamazepine can actually treat peripheral myoclonus, but can worsen cortical myoclonus. Those are less likely to be on a med list than gabapentin and pregabalin or Lyrica. Those are biggies, especially in hospitalized patients who may come in with a little AKI. They've got a little bit of a worse creatinine clearance than they did at home. And all of a sudden, those medications that are renally cleared, like gabapentin and pregabalin, end up at toxic levels in those patients and start to cause multifocal myoclonus. Those are, I think, 40% of inpatient consults on multifocal myoclonus is going to be one of those medications. Opiates is another big one. And then you mentioned a lot of psychiatric medications, and mostly, you know, narrowing in on the medications that can cause serotonergic overload and serotonin syndrome, as myoclonus is one of the things that helps us to differentiate without a med history, which of course is the most helpful, helps us to differentiate serotonin syndrome versus neuroleptic malignant syndrome versus Parkinsonian hyperpyrexia syndrome, all of which have fever and rigidity and potentially some CK elevations. But myoclonus is quite common with serotonergic overload as well as hyperreflexia.
And every neurology resident, every neurologist needs to know that sodium channel blocking agents can worsen myoclonic epilepsy syndromes, can worsen epileptic myoclonus in many cases, and should specifically be avoided in one of the myoclonus syndromes that we're going to talk about, progressive myoclonic epilepsy in infancy, also known as Dravet syndrome, which is related to a mutation in the sodium channel gene, and sodium channel blocking agents can make that much worse. So sodium channels and myoclonus is something that should be well known.
Similarly, when you're seeing your post-cardiac arrest patients who are in myoclonic status epilepticus, or later with Lance Adams syndrome with cortical myoclonic spikes, you're going to be avoiding those medications in those patients and throwing all of the other medications at them that aren't going to worsen the situation.
So outside of the medications, more generally speaking, we can also just think about just common metabolic derangements, hepatic failure, renal failure. The sodium, calcium, magnesium, all are just a very brief, good look through the chart just to make sure none of those derangements are there, because they can also similarly worsen and contribute to a more generalized multifocal myoclonus. And now, to be a little bit more focused, we can start talking about some of the cortically based myoclonic syndromes and the differential that's more related to central neurologic processes. So I think we can start focal nervous system lesions, be it post-stroke, tumors, trauma, all of those ultimately can lead to a cortical myoclonic process.
Can I just add something about toxic metabolic before we move on? So you mentioned, you know, renal and hepatic failure, so uremia, hyperammonemia, electrolyte disturbances. But the other thing to look at is chronic hypoxia and chronic hypercarbia. Especially the hypercarbia can go unnoticed. People, for example, with COPD or with undiagnosed or untreated obstructive sleep apnea can develop multifocal myoclonus, and treating the underlying issue can help with that.
Thank you for that. Definitely one thing we see a lot of in the hospital as well, a lot of undiagnosed sleep apnea. So at this point, Dr. Moeller, do you want to kind of go into the considerations for epileptic myoclonus?
Yeah, I think this is worth a subtle little diversion, because I think it's one of the most common types of cortical myoclonus besides that related to toxic and metabolic disorders, as we've discussed. A framing about how to think of syndromes that can produce epileptic myoclonus, I think a useful framing would be to consider two main factors, the first being the age of onset and the second being severity. So the general ages of onset of disorders would be those that occur in early infancy, you know, right after birth, within the first weeks to months. Those that occur in infancy, but maybe a little later. Those that start in childhood, and those that may start later on in life. And I think if you divide it into those categories, you can generate a more concise list of disorders, and it will allow you to hone your illness scripts as you're preparing for examinations and as you're caring for patients. I'll start with the area which I am least comfortable with, which would be early infancy. I am an adult epileptologist. But in early infancy, you can have benign neonatal seizures, which can sometimes have clonic or myoclonic components. And then your more severe myoclonic seizures that occur in early infancy are going to be those related to disorders like early infantile epileptic encephalopathy, Ohtahara syndrome, which can have tonic, myoclonic, and other seizure types. This is a much more severe neurological disorder. it can be associated with severe neurological dysfunction and a burst suppression, discontinuous pattern on EEG, and can be progressive and very difficult to treat. A little bit later, you can have benign myoclonic epilepsy of infancy, sort of later in infancy. This tends to occur in the first year of life. There are myoclonic seizures that are self-limited. These patients tend to have normal development. And then you can have much more severe and progressive worsening myoclonic epilepsy. And I mentioned this before, progressive myoclonic epilepsy of infancy, also known as Dravet syndrome, related to a mutation of the SCN1A gene. Often the first seizures are febrile, febrile clonic seizures. Then there can be a mixture of multiple seizure types, including myoclonic seizures, and often a progressive neurological worsening. This is a disorder in which the sodium channel blocking agents should be avoided. If we move to sort of the next age, which would be childhood, one of the more well-known disorders, although it's not that common, would be epilepsy with myoclonic atonic seizures. They used to be called myoclonic astatic seizures. And this is DOSA syndrome, tends to occur in late infancy or early childhood and can be associated with seizures with both cortical myoclonus and often a drop, a sudden loss of tone. So this myoclonic atonic seizures and sometimes bilateral tonic-clonic seizures as well. Sometimes is treated with the ketogenic diet or anti-seizure medications. A little bit later, juvenile myoclonic epilepsy, and I'm not going to get into much detail about that, tends to start in teenage years or early 20s, rarely later than that. Generalized polyspike waves on EEG, photomyoclonic response in many patients, prominent response with sleep deprivation, alcohol, et cetera, generally responsive to anti-seizure medications and generally has a decent prognosis, but patients often have to stay on medications lifelong. And then the last category, and this is your mixed bag of category, is the progressive myoclonic epilepsy syndromes. And those are syndromes which are characterized by seizures, including myoclonic seizures, and progressive neurological disease of various types. And I'm just going to briefly mention a few things about each of these for the purposes of our listeners, just making a mental checklist. You know, these have really interesting names in some cases. So one of the progressive myoclonus epilepsy syndromes is Unverricht-Lundborg disease, also known as Baltic myoclonus, tends to have onset in school age or teenage years. Prominently stimulus-sensitive myoclonus. It's an autosomal recessive disorder, and there is a specific gene, the CSTB, also known as the EPM1 gene. I don't think it's as important to understand that, but it is an autosomal recessive genetic disorder. Variable severity, but myoclonus, along with other progressive neurological deficits, which can include cerebellar dysfunction, cognitive dysfunction, etc. Lafora disease, another with onset in teenage years, EPM2 gene. So these EPM genes, the labeling system has to do with them being progressive myoclonus, epilepsy with progressive myoclonus, EPM. And this one is EPM2A. It's a ribosomal encoding gene, also autosomal recessive. And the classic thing to know about Lafora disease is that there are Lafora bodies seen on skin biopsy. There is myoclonic epilepsy with ragged red fibers, which is a mitochondrial disorder. And the ragged red fibers should be the clue. You see ragged red fibers on muscle biopsy, which is an indicator of a mitochondrial disorder. These patients often have a myopathy in addition to the myoclonus because of the mitochondrial disorder. Short stature, can have hearing loss or optic atrophy. And again, all of those would be clues that this is a mitochondrial disease. And ragged red fibers, of course, are clumps of diseased mitochondria that tend to exist on the edges of each muscle fiber and are seen best on a Gomori trichrome stain. So this used to be something that we had to be aware of when we prepared for exams. There's the neuronal ceroid lipofuscinoses. These tend to occur in childhood or early teenage years. And there are multiple different types, and they're usually autosomal recessive. And they're sort of a classic type and then other types. The NCLs tend to be rapidly progressive, and often there is a severe macular degeneration. And one of the things that can be seen on EEG with the NCLs is an exaggerated photic response with low frequency photic stimulation, possibly related to the macular issues. There's the sialidoses, which are also autosomal recessive, tend to occur juvenile or can occur in adulthood. So this is could be one of the ones that's later onset. And you see the cherry red spot on the retina, which is an important element of this disorder. The sialidoses tend to be a lysosomal disorder. There's dentatorubral pallidoluysian atrophy, or DERPLA. I think I'm sticking the landing with each one of these. Very importantly, this is a trinucleotide repeat disorder. The repeat is CAG and the atrophin 1 gene. It's autosomal dominant, and often you see midline atrophy on MRI structures along with white matter changes. And this can have a later onset as well. So one to be known about that can occur in juvenile years or even in adulthood. So there's my list of progressive myoclonus epilepsy syndromes and some of the buzzwords that you would need to know about these, but just so you're aware of these. You know, the takeaway, the most common ones you're going to see on an examination and in life, JME, know that one inside and out. You should understand Dravet syndrome. It's probably a good idea to understand something about DOSA syndrome and perhaps some of the benign disorders, which can be clinically relevant.
I should say that I have diagnosed juvenile myoclonic epilepsy in my movement clinic. A patient who was sent to me for myoclonus had never had a seizure, to his knowledge, and on history was having early morning myoclonus within the first hour of awakening, which is classic. So you do see it, even if you're not an epileptologist.
Well, that was fantastic. Thank you, Dr. Mueller. I really appreciate you going through the epilepsy syndromes that we should be thinking about for myoclonus. I think the setting it up in terms of thinking about it through early infancy, childhood, and then later on in those progressive epilepsy syndromes is exceptionally helpful. So thank you for that.
Yeah, this is a scary topic. And I think dividing by age and then by severity can really help you break it down. And there's only, well, I'm sure there are more, but there's only a few in each of those boxes, if you go progressively by age and severity, that you really need to know about. And look, if you can narrow down and say, I think this person has a progressive myoclonic epilepsy syndrome, then you can go back to the books and look up what you need to be looking for.
Very true. Definitely good to fall back to resources when needed. I won't even attempt to pronounce some of them that you went through. So in terms of other cortical syndromes that we can think about just a little bit more briefly, we can think about neurodegenerative conditions as well that are related to more generalized myoclonic activity. I think one of the classic ones that we may think about is going to be prion diseases like CJD, specifically when looking for more of a startle myoclonic activity. And then we can think about most of the dementias. So CBD, so cortical basal degeneration, dementia with Lewy body, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, they can all be associated with a degree of myoclonic activity moving down the line with progression of their disease. Outside of neurodegenerative conditions, we can think a little bit more broadly about infectious, post-infectious conditions. A lot of viruses can definitely be associated with a myoclonic presentation. HSV, HIV can all be associated with some myoclonus. Outside of that, Lyme disease, specifically syphilis or Whipple's disease, which is associated with several hyperkinetic movement disorders, can also be associated with myoclonus as well. Those are going to be a little less common, but obviously if somebody's coming in with a prodrome of fevers, chills, infectious contacts, particularly if we're thinking about arboviruses or Lyme disease, if there's any sort of environmental exposure that would really push us down an infectious etiology. Outside of infection, we can also think about some autoimmune conditions, specifically just paraneoplastic disorders that are associated with myoclonus. Would be, you could think about opsoclonus myoclonus syndrome. So in children, we'd be thinking about children with neuroblastoma. Then in adults, this is more related to small cell lung cancer, breast cancer, and this would be a generalized myoclonic syndrome, but also predominant abnormalities in eye movements. So the opsoclonus part of these syndromes is something that's very interesting to see clinically. And in the setting of a backdrop of malignancy, your concern for malignancy is something worth thinking about. Some more encephalitis like NMDA encephalitis can be associated with myoclonus. More movement-related paraneoplastic and autoimmune conditions like stiff person syndrome or progressive encephalomyelitis with rigidity and myoclonus or PERM can similarly be associated with more diffuse myoclonic pictures. And obviously in these patients, we're looking more, thinking more about malignancy history or risk for other autoimmune conditions.
No, I mean, I would just say that there are a lot of autoimmune conditions that have been reported with myoclonus, and it helps that some of them say myoclonus in the name, hopsoclonus, myoclonus, and PERM. But any cortical hyperexcitability, voltage gated potassium channel encephalitides, all sorts of things can cause myoclonus.
And then outside of that, I guess we've already kind of alluded to Lance Adams a few times already at this point. I think that one's okay. I think we've covered that one at this point. And I think you also alluded to the myoclonic dystonias as well before. So I think we've covered that one. In terms of evaluating the cortical or subcortical processes for myoclonus, a lot of it will be kind of generated by your clinical history and what you see on exam and the overall setting of the patient. Obviously, if we're leaning towards an autoimmune process or an infectious process, MRI imaging, CSF studies, serum studies are all within the realm of things that you'd want to look into and would want to work up. If we're thinking more along the lines of progressive epilepsy syndrome or seizure, definitely EEG and maybe correlation with EMG would be very helpful in order to better classify and evaluate those. And obviously, if we're getting into more genetic etiologies where they're fitting into specific syndromes, considering mitochondrial studies, considering specific targeted genetic tests would all be exceptionally reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, as we've talked about, myoclonus can come from anywhere on the neuroaxis and can come from almost anything that you can think of. And so your evaluation is going to be very patient specific.
So at this point, I think we've done a good job covering overall etiologies. We've definitely covered a pretty wide array at this point that can really lead to myoclonus. So just to kind of end, I think we can talk briefly a little bit about treatment and treatment considerations. The first key step to myoclonus, especially in somebody who's generally ill, admitted to the hospital with a multifocal myoclonus, first and foremost is treat the underlying cause that you think is here. So if it's related to medications, peel those back and see if that leads to the improvement, if at all possible. If there's any underlying metabolic derangements, definitely go and correct those initially to see if you get any improvement. But stepping back and thinking more towards where we've localized. So if we're thinking more of a cortical myoclonic process, some agents that have at least been helpful outside of specifically epilepsy or specific syndromes, you can consider the use of valproate or levetiracetam. And one that will be utilized pretty much throughout the neuroaxis and will be helpful for myoclonus will be benzos like clonazepam. Particularly in subcortical myoclonus, clonazepam will be the most helpful agent. And that is similar when thinking about spinal myoclonic processes as well. So then once we're kind of out of the spine, moving towards segmental and peripheral, one of the things that has seemed to be useful has been botulinum toxin. So really focal injections in order to treat the underlying muscles that are most implicated in the myoclonic process.
Yeah, if you have any movement disorder that's focal enough, then Botox is going to be a better option if possible, because all of the medications we use for movement disorders are sedating. And when given systemically in doses high enough to actually impact the movement disorder, the side effects can be a big problem. So we do love Botox for our peripheral myoclonus, our hemifacial spasm patients. Some of my patients do take carbamazepine and Botox, or they take carbamazepine for the several weeks as the Botox is wearing off before they're due for their next dose, for example. But the vast majority of my patients exclusively use Botox for peripheral myoclonus. Some other things to consider, kind of similar to trigeminal neuralgia, would be like muscle relaxants like baclofen, medications that we use for lots of different neurological conditions like gabapentin and things like that. But really, carbamazepine has the best data in those peripheral patients. And then, you know, avoiding any medications that could worsen things. So if you're concerned about cortical myoclonus, again, avoiding those sodium channel blockers like phenytoin and carbamazepine.
No, agreed. I definitely think the Botox is definitely super helpful for a lot of these patients in terms of avoiding the systemic side effects, and definitely good to consider the other medications that a patient is on and make sure that we're not the ones exacerbating anything, especially when thinking about the sodium channel blockers. So I think those are all fantastic points.
I have to say the patients that come to my clinic for quote unquote tremor and end up with multifocal myoclonus due to toxic metabolic issues are my happiest of all patients, because I take them off their gabapentin or I treat their sleep apnea or whatever is going on, and they're all better. They are the most grateful people.
Good to have satisfied customers.
Indeed.
And I don't know how many times we've said on this podcast in various different episodes, a medication reconciliation will help your patient.
Absolutely. Critical.
Well, thank you all so much for the help with this talk. It's definitely a bit of a bear of a topic to go through just because of how diffuse and how many different things can really contribute to myoclonus. But I'm hopeful that this is helpful to a lot of people to go through some of the phenomenology, a general approach to localization, some of the more common etiologies, and particularly etiologies that we as residents will get tested on relatively frequently. And then also some of the at least basic treatments and at least considerations for treatment based on that localization. So I really appreciate all the help with this one, guys.
I think we tackled the bear. I'm not sure how to handle that metaphor. Captured the bear, tamed the bear. Anyway, whatever we did with the bear, it was a positive thing. And Aaron, you deserve a lot of credit for narrowing this down, I think, into very bite-sized chunks for the bear to eat. And I'll stop now. This has just been so much fun. And I learned a ton about this from both of you.
I learned a lot about pediatric epilepsy syndrome. So
there's a lot of those.
Lifelong learning, everybody.
All right. Thanks, Aaron. Thank you all. Thanks, Sarah.
No problem.
Thanks.